I think that was 10 seconds to start. So I'd like to welcome everyone joining this webinar today. We have I myself is I'm my name is Jörgen Lian, and I am the head of shipping equity research at DNB Carnegie. So welcome to this Capital Link's shipping sector webinar series. Today we will be discussing the latest trends, opportunities, and outlook on the crude tanker market. We're lucky to have with us prominent voices of the industry. On the webinar today, we have Svein Moxnes Harfjeld, who is President and CEO of DHT Holdings. We have Lars Barstad, who is the CEO of Frontline Management. We have Nicolas Tsakos, the founder and CEO of Tsakos Energy Navigation. And last but not least, we have Mikkel Seidlin, the CCO in TK Tankers. The webinar it will feature a roundtable discussion with our panelists, followed by a Q&A session, and will run for approximately 45 minutes. We'll try to stick to that. Participants, they may submit questions at any time using the Q&A button on the webinar platform, so please do. We will do our best to address them during the Q&A segment. Please note that questions should focus on the crude tanker sector. Please also note that these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or any other form of advice. Lastly, this webinar is being recorded today, Tuesday, December 16th, 2025, and will be available later as an on-demand replay. And with all the formalities being said, then we can start. I myself have been looking forward to the winter market this year. It seemed like all stars were aligned and markets were set up very well for a strong crude tanker market, and we have seen that materialize as well. Just starting on the current situation and a bit, you know, what has been going on and what are we seeing in the short term that could drive rates even further this winter? Is the peak behind us, or is there more to look forward to in the short term? And maybe I can start with Lars on that one.
Yeah, thank you, Jørgen. It's you know, I'm always afraid to jinx things. And for sure we have a very firm market now. I think what's different now from what we've seen for quite a few years actually is that there is a tremendous amount of volume being concluded at the rates we're seeing now, and I'm not now talking specifically about the VLCCs. So you know, between $110,000 and $120,000 per day, business is actually being conducted. If you look back at the spike we had in June in relation to you know, the Iran, Israel, US kind of debacle, virtually no ships were fixed at the peak. Now we've had, and we actually do statistics on this, we have had 23 days where the Baltic Index, the 43C, in TC terms, has printed north of $100,000 per day. Last time that happened was in 2020. Prior to that, you have to go back to 2008 to find a similar period. So it's quite firm. Whether if there is more room to the upside, you know, historically, December is a short month, basically because charterers and owners tend to have some holidays too. The Baltic Index doesn't print between Christmas and New Year still. So there is a chance that we can have some hectic days, you know, as the January stems in the Middle East needs to get covered. And that's basically going to start happening any minute now.
Perfect, thank you. And then Svein, because there is a very pronounced seasonality effect here, especially on the VLCCs historically, right? And I do get questions, so therefore today it's I'm able to ask them on to you. When investors ask me, you know, should you buy in at these types of rate levels in the seasonal peak, you can say, of the year, what would be a short pitch as to why, Svein?
I would say yes, because the earnings today for the companies, you know, is quite is phenomenal, really. And it means companies are building NAV. Whether they retain the money in the company or whether they pay it out one way or another, it's a value creation process going on for investors. So they should not be worried about, you know, some companies like on this call, Frontline, ourselves trading at the premium, because both companies will continue to earn solid money and build NAV. And also with generous policies, you know, these earnings will be shared partly with the shareholders.
That was perfect, short and sweet. And then, Mikhail, moving away a bit from the larger tankers into the more mid-size segment. Do you echo what has been said in terms of the drivers, or is there anything particular that you are looking out for near term?
No, I think it's very similar to what we're seeing as well. I think looking back the last 3 years, it's been a different story. Of course, you've seen the Aframaxes and Suezmax sort of been carrying the market, and at times been capped out by the VLCC. So seeing this spike now, even though I mean, some data just looking at it, we have seen a little bit less loadings, a little bit less ton mile going into December, but it's from such a big high, and there's such an undersupply of VLCCs already. So I think that it has a lot of steam still. But the fact that the Vs are sort of moving on their own, it has dragged up the Suezmaxes as well. And as mentioned before, I think there are some of the stuff is some of the reasons some of the demand has been created is turnarounds in China that is an amplified and happening this time of the year. So the weather is having a amplifying effect of what we're already seeing, but the underlying is in terms of ton mile being created, in terms of just more oil on the water, it will last for a while. Is our view, and it will pull up the Suezmaxes, and then the Suezmaxes will get out of the way of the Aframaxes, and having that knock-on effect for once that way in the last for the first time probably in the last 3 years, which is great to see.
Yeah, good. And then Niklas, I assume we're pretty much on the same page when it comes to the market and such. But we have seen some of these geopolitical tensions escalate a bit further with the U.S. Targeting Venezuelan-linked ships, etc. What's your take on that in terms of a trigger for driving the market even further? And does that impact you directly in any way?
Well, I mean, we are, as you know, diversified, in everything from VLs down to products. So I think we feel the positive tone in the whole markets. Even the smaller vessels, which is a small part of our portfolio, in the last couple of weeks, are doing much better than 30s and 40s. So the whole market, I think it's the ones who spoke before say it's in a positive situation. I think the market has legs to go, and it's good when you have the VLs in 100 plus, 120 plus. I think this brings the whole market, and really the cold weather has not started yet in our, I think. In a northern hemisphere. I mean, I see all our friends from Oslo. They're all just wearing a sleeveless shirts, and I'm the only one dressed warmly. But so I think yes, the market has legs going forward, and even if the market corrects a bit, we are in a very good base.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's hot here actually still. So there's more to go. Lars, you've been a proponent for the sanctions regime and things tightening further than it has been, because we have seen a lot of the ton mile demand being taken on this illicit trades and shadow fleet rather than the compliant fleet. What do you say to the situation that we're seeing now with the US boarding ships off of Venezuela? Is that potent in your opinion? Thoughts?
I'm not 100% sure if Venezuela alone is potent, but I think kind of the policy and the move can potentially be very potent because U.S. is showing a will to try and deal with the situation around Venezuela, not only on oil but other issues as well. I think kind of in the long term, this can be kind of extremely good for the market. Venezuela used to be a very busy country for oil exports and a big provider of ton miles until, of course, the regime destroyed some of their production capabilities and so forth. So I think kind of that development is a positive long term, but short term, I'm actually not 100% sure how it needs to play out first. But I think on a general note, what we're seeing now is, we have kind of record high oil in transit. We have record high not record high, but quite substantial amount of oil kind of in the one way or another floating storage. And I think it's, you know, one of the key causes for this is that sanctioned crude is struggling to find a home. And this is good because it means that actors are actually switching towards compliant barrels, which benefits owners that shy away from the gray or the dark kind of oils. Where this is going to lead us is difficult to say because you know, oil will find a home in the end, and how that is done is of course the key question here. But I think kind of what we've seen is. And we've been arguing for this for a while, actually too long, is that eventually incremental growth from the sanctioned countries is going to stop incremental growth of volume and oil and exports. And then we're back to kind of the compliant market, you know, supplying the marginal barrel to the market. And I think that's probably the big trend that we've seen. And it, you know, it was accelerated by how India and you know, further out China conducting themselves in this market, but you know, I think that was inevitable to happen at any point anyhow. So I think kind of we have potentially turned a corner. I didn't expect the corner to be that quick, and this is why, you know, we expect some volatility going forward. But I think sanctions are a key part of the story we're seeing in front of us now, basically because we have an enormous amount of tonnage that is actually not qualified for trading in the compliant market. And this makes it's a very exciting kind of next steps, you know, as we move into 2026.
Yeah, I agree. I found this interesting. It continues to compile on reasons, I think, to be bullish on the longer term outlook where... Of course, this fleet now includes a lot of old tonnage that at some point needs to be phased out. Question is when and how that will happen. But then if we turn a bit to the longevity of the tanker cycle, because right now there's a lot of focus, I know also from the investors, on the short-term rates and where things are headed near-term. But I think the important part here is trying to understand how firm this looks when you look a bit further ahead. And I'll turn that over to you, Svein, because beyond this winter, right, especially if we focus on the VLCCs first, then we can go a bit broader and on the smaller sizes afterwards. But on the VLCC side, you know, there's still rather limited fleet growth next year before it then starts to pick up again some by 2027. So what's your view on the supply demand side? And I guess the most important part is understanding what will be the demand driver to offset that fleet growth in this sector in the time ahead.
I think, first of all, you know, large tankers will always be a volatile sector. So... And when you are at, you know, strong markets like now, volatility in nominal terms can be quite scary numbers. You could have sort of things flipping, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a day, but that should not be a reason to be worried about being in the IR space. But to respond to your question, this year, I think the expectations for demand growth is about 1 million barrel per day. And the forecast for next year is a bit higher than that. I think Saudi Aramco made the right call in a way when they sort of pushed OPEC to do what they have been doing and providing more oil to the market. And it's quite clear with how the oil prices are really holding up in a way that the market needed this oil. So the other aspect of this is the majority of that demand is now satisfied by seaborne growth. So if you look at total demand growth of crude oil only, it's sort of in the low mid-80s, about 40 million plus of that is seaborne. When that grows almost 1 million, that's a 2.5% demand growth, right? And you will see the same, if not higher, next year. And all this is going by ships. And in a phase now where I think you have to go at least into 2029 to see some sort of the supply side changing really the fleet structure because the fleet is aging so fast. And if you forward to end of 2028, we will have 50% of the fleet will be older than 15 years of age, or 25% older than 20. And this is extraordinary numbers. So I think we are up for a pretty good period now, still with some swings and volatility, but in general, it will be very good earnings for tanker companies for quite a good period. So I would not be sort of worried about this only being a winter phenomenon.
No, I tend to agree. And Niklas, if you want to comment anything further on that, I think it's interesting to see how, you know, you had quite a lot of non-OPEC growth that's been a bit more dated, takes time to get to market. It's been coming into the Atlantic, moving that long haul. But that dries up, I believe, from 27, if I'm not incorrect. So are we still as positive on the demand side in tankers in 27 and beyond, Niklas?
Yes, I think that our industry is always affected by the oversupply of tonnage for reasons of technology and for reasons that have to do with environmental issues. There has been uncertainty, so people have been careful in overordering. And I think that's why we're facing, together with the geopolitical events right now, a positive market for the next 2 or 3 years. I hope we're not going to shoot ourselves on the foot again and go on crazy ordering of ships, because our industry is really inelastic. I mean, we always have growing demand, but if we overbuild, then that goes out of the way. The good thing is that the industry is becoming less fragmented, at least in the bigger sizes, where you have big, mainly public companies like the peer group that we have here. And they have, of course, checks and balances in order to avoid overflooding the market with tonnage. So I think we are in a change of the industry characteristics, at least for the tankers. We are becoming much more industrial shipping. This is our model as 10. We have close to 75% of our business fixed forward with an average of 5 years. And we have profit sharings to take advantage for the market. So I think analysts like your good selves will have to look at our companies, all the peer group, more on a PE rather than a net asset value, which I think the net asset value is really completely not the right way to value tanker companies with a long track record, like all the ones that are here with us today.
Okay. And with the risk of becoming the devil at this panel, though, none of you are too concerned with this peak oil demand that people talked about a couple of years back. That's now gone and no longer an issue for the demand growth in tankers. Mm-hmm. I'll leave that open to anyone who wants to answer.
I can take a shot at that. I mean, we spend a lot of time on this, working with some of the leading energy analysts out there, three different firms now that we've been engaged with. And all along, it was quite clear to us that a potential peak demand could happen sort of in the mid 2030s. But a very important takeaway from that work is that peak demand is not demand falling off a cliff. It's very likely a plateau that could last some 10 years out. So if you think globally about that, maybe oil consumption per capita is declining a bit, because the nominal numbers is likely to stay elevated for quite a long time. And you see now it's very difficult to actually move away from fossil fuels. I saw now recently or today in the FT, writing that the EU now is considering removing the ban on combustion engines from 2020-35. So this is a big recognition, right, that this ambitious policy statements that came out during all this ESG frenzy, they recognize now it's not doable, frankly. It's very simple. So it will go in reverse. And, you know, we have done a lot of good work in shipping. Engines have become much more economical, consuming less fuel, improving and all that. So has cars, so has airplanes. So it's improving, but consumption is still increasing because it's very hard to move away from fossil fuels.
I think this is a very good point, and having the grayer here of you guys here. I remember we were talking about peak oil to be at the turn of the century, at 2000. It moved to 2020. I think right now from the drilling, that the deep sea drilling, which we participate in a big way with our shuttle tankers, which is going, I think, from strength to strength. You know, I think even 2030, I think it's going to be after 2030, you know, and for quite some time. So I think yes, the commodity that we transfer, it will still be in demand. I don't think we have reached peak oil. Every, you know, as I said, there were times that we thought we would reach it, but it has not come through.
Then I got in a question here as well, which I think fits well into this discussion, but because there's been quite a bit of talk of the imports and flows have been actually pretty good compared to some numbers on the underlying demand side. So I guess a very relevant question, perhaps to Mikkel or to Lars, what do you think about that? As are we building up inventory, and will that at some point then lead to a reversal in this demand growth that we have seen that has been dragging up or pulling up rates this year? But Mikkel,
yeah, I mean, we definitely, there has been inventory growth this year, and that's expected to continue next year as well. And then what that's going to do if OPEC continues to unroll their cuts or maintain their current production, and you see non-OPEC also continuing to pump, it should lead to an oversupply in the short term, which again, if that continues, there's an argument, and we have heard it many times, that the front end of the oil price will collapse, and that will lead to a contango, which should then continue this current strong market that we're seeing right now. It should encourage more, probably not a floating storage, but it will continue to encourage the long haul voyages that we've seen that have picked up the VLCC market and by extension the Suezmax market. I think what's worth bearing in mind as well, so that's definitely a factor. The question is, will OPEC allow for this to happen? Are they happy to, like they would do in the good or bad old days, where they would flood the market and flush out some of the higher cost oil producers in the short term by just oversupplying the market and seeing the prices come off, or will they adjust and cut a little bit earlier before we see the contango come in? So then that will then of course affect when are we going to see the peak of the current spike, and when we'll see a potential softening a little bit. But even if we do see a softening, I do think the market is so tight and on the supply side that I don't think we're going to have. We don't believe, at least, that we're going to have a complete collapse. It's simply too tight. That's when every time we see a new event happening, geopolitical, weather, whatever it might be, we see rates react, and that means there's no extra surplus of tonnage to be provided. And every event that could have an impact on one way or the other, there's always an upside. Once you go deep enough into the rabbit hole, there will be a knock-on effect. Venezuela was mentioned before. Yes, of course, if Venezuela doesn't sell to China anymore, China will need to replace some of the heavy sours. TMX is a good example of that. So then we'll see more ton miles on the Aframaxes in the Pacific. And then that will then knock on something on the VLCC side. So it just seems to be that when the rates react as much and as quick as they do now, it tells you something about the fundamentals of the market. Even though we might see an oversupply in the tonnage, which might have a cool things off a little bit in the short term, but it will something else will come up, and it has been, and especially when we see this supply picture being as tight as it is again. I think, as I mentioned before, I think we see about the VLCC market to balance, you need at least 40 more ships the way the world looks today, and I don't see where that's going to come from anytime soon.
Okay. Do you concur with that, Lars? I think because it's a fair question. If we've got a lot of the demand uplift now, right, and there might be a destocking on the horizon at some place, maybe in the period when we're reliant on OPEC adding volume, since non-OPEC are perhaps rolling back on growth into the Atlantic that we've seen in this year in 26. What would you say, Lars?
So it's kind of the question you're raising is, of course, I think in oil, the biggest question of them all. There are indications that demand is potentially a bit higher than what IEA are advocating, and EIA potentially. Right now, it's if you look at how crude is pricing, OPEC's model is probably the one showing kind of the most proof, because we're actually supposed to be building close to 3.5 million barrels per day now. looking at the supply and demand balance kind of in these various reports. But I just want to circle a little bit back to what we talked about previously, because it's all connected together, right? Like Nicolas mentioned, you know, we're coming from a world in 2019 where we actually expected never to recover to 100 million barrels per day of post-COVID. And then, of course, we had the green kind of cycle. You know, even the oil majors now are starting to sharpen their pen on investing in oil production again, or exploration and production again, because there is a realization around us that oil is a bit sticky. It's a difficult molecule to avoid, and particularly so, you know, when you think about kind of you know, most of the agitators for you know, the green shift are living in OECD, but non-OECD are actually the largest amount of people, and they can't afford being green. They want to, you know, get warm first and cook their food first, and you know, kind of have heating first. So it's and I think this is the realization that is probably coming through right now. When you look at the balances, it's you know, I would not be surprised if EIA and IEA and all these guys needed to adjust their demand side upwards as we move into 2026. We're extremely well supplied. OPEC, there's probably not room for them continuing the increase, looking at the amount of oil we have around, kicking around now in 2026. But you know, it could be that they are, as Mikkel pointed to, they are in a, you know, bit of a policy change where they want to go for market share rather than absolute price. So, but I think kind of any which way you look at this, it looks constructive at least. You know, it's number one. I think in my kind of short period in shipping, only 20 years, I haven't seen as much political uncertainty kind of in our analysis. But secondly, I haven't really seen such an old tanker fleet either. So it's kind of an interesting prospect going forward.
Yeah, good. Thank you. And then if we, I'd like to go back to Mikkel actually on the mid size a bit, because we talked a bit about the supply side on the larger tankers, and of course next year, at least a lot of pushback that I'm getting is that there's more orders and deliveries coming in, continuing to come in on the mid size tanker side. So my question to you, is that something that you fear? And then secondly, I there's a lot of talk about scrapping, right? But you also at TK Tankers, you do have quite a few older ships that you're actually managing to trade quite well. So my question to you, how hard is it to trade the vessel that's approaching 20 years of age in today's market?
I mean, first of all, Jan, we don't fear anything at TK, but that aside, no, we've been lucky. We have our technical management team. They've done a great job in keeping the ships competitive, keeping retrofitting for fuel savings initiatives, and we have the benefit of having everything in house. So it's easy to find what is the return on the investment. It goes straight to the shared bottom line. There's no one has to get a piece of it. There's no padded lines in between. We know exactly what we're paying for. We know it's pretty well what we're going to get. So that has helped us a lot in terms of how managing these kind of these ships. That said, of course, they won't last forever. And a couple of years ago, as I'm sure most of you will remember or be aware of, the hard line for how long you can take trade a tanker for effectively was 15 years. I think with some confidence, we can say that can definitely burn out to 20. But I do. We don't. It's going to be hard to go beyond 20 in a meaningful way. That comment might not age well, but that's definitely our view at the moment. So we have actively tried to exit some of the older tonnage this year. We sold about 11 tankers, and at the same time also slowly starting to rebuild the fleet as well. But yes, I mean, if you're managing holistically, I think you can get a lot of out of the steel you have on the water in that respect. In terms of the scrappings, if we see more of that going on and the order book coming in, yes, it is a fairly large order book. We a lot of the older tonnage, as mentioned before, that it a lot of it is part of the shadow fleet, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second. If we see the order book, it becomes sort of self-fulfilling policy or philosophy almost, like where you have, if the order book comes in and collapses the market, you have what you can refer to as almost release valves in the older tanker fleet. If the market, the only reason why a lot of these ships are around is because they're still making money. If you have an oversupplied situation, those ships will leave the fleet. Whether they get scrapped or they're being laid up and become untradeable, it's not that important from the market point of view, but it will tighten up the supply of tonnage again, and it should mean that if we see a dip, it should be short-lived.
Yeah, I agree. That's probably the best argument to be around in tankers, that the downside is somewhat capped given what's been going on. But I was hoping you were going to say there's a lot of LR2s that do the crude transport work as well. That was what I was fishing for. Sure. But if I move to Nicholas, because I've heard from some traders in the industry that the barrier to swing capacity between crude and product has sort of been eased quite a lot given what's been going on over the past few years. So is that, we look at it quite simply, tankers are tankers to some extent and they're highly correlated. Is that true, would you say, Nicholas? Is it easy to switch tankers back and forth and do whatever makes the most money?
Well, I think for operations like ourselves, who we do everything in this building where we are with 300 people managing the ships, For ships that are 10 years or younger, the switch is an easy one and not very costly. So the ships can switch from products to crude. But then going back to the point, I think 20 years right now is the sweet spot. It used to be 15 years, but I think the demand, and there's good quality ships still close to 20 years that are trading. I mean, I have an example which is... there's one, we have 20 ships on order, all of them with long-term employment, and we still have a vessel which is older than my kids. So it's my daughter's just turned 21, so that's older than 21, and major oil companies still on trade here on time charter. We're trying to actually sell the ship, and every time we try to tell them, we get another year extension at a rate that will not allow us to sell here. So for good quality ships, I think that there is still place in the trades. And of course, the release valve, which you have discussed, is, and I know you're going to go there later, that a big part of the mid-size fleet has turned gray on us. So this part of the fleet. Is not, we do not see it, we do not compete with it. It's not in the main street market that we all of us, I guess, operate.
Yeah, I agree. I know time is running away from us as it always does when we talk about these things. Let's move then to the gray fleet, and especially we'll try to get through this relatively quickly because there's a lot of focus on it otherwise. But I remember you had a very interesting comment at our conference earlier this year as well, Svein, I think, on the impacts in case of a ceasefire in Ukraine and what that would mean for tankers. Because it's true what you're saying, right? There's become a huge gray fleet, but they do a lot of the transport work. So the question here is, how certain are we that these vessels are taken out? That's one answer. But how does the ton-mile balance and then the shift in trade flows look when and if that happens, Svein?
March is a long time ago. I'm not sure I remember what I said then, but I think of course this the war Russia-Ukraine situation disrupted a lot of the trading activity, and of course if we come into a peace situation, I think it very much depends how did we get to peace. Is it a peace because it's negotiated and there's several parties to this agreement that will make concessions and how to restore sort of some sort of normality? Or is it a peace because Russia simply won the war? So I think that, outcomes of those situations are going to be very, very different. But in general, if Russia, for some reason, are able to sell their oil to Europe again, then you will reverse that this disruption you had starting some, two, 3 years ago. And then more Atlantic barrels will move to the east again, and it's going to be sort of a big ship business as we had before that happened. So I think it's that's not any difficult logic to that scenario. I think that's quite common, but it all really hinges on whether Russia can access Europe again or not. That oil will find a home at some point. These old ships today are serving a purpose, but they become much less productive. I think that is also an important part to understand, that the VLCC today doing sanctioned oil is maybe doing one, luckily two cargoes a year. So they're not really, carrying that much oil. So this is supporting some of the things that Lars talked about earlier, how much oil there is in the market and how the compliant fleet is gradually grinding in, taking the role at that oil is becoming generally more compliant. So I think there's a positive outcome, especially for the big ships, if this happens. I don't mean to just talk our own book on that. I think it's reasonable logic behind that scenario.
Okay. I'll allow you to come with a short comment if you want to, Mikkel, but I think, it makes a lot of sense on the smaller versus the large ships on where trade flows might evolve. Or
no, I heard that pitch from Svein before, and it's hard to argue with, to be fair. I mean, we have to bear in mind that, the ton-mile increased in 22 because of the war by 5.4% and increased another 7.2% in 23. And that was almost all hit straight smack down into the medium-sized tankers. So, of course, if you have an end to the conflict in a meaningful way where trade patterns reverse, then it's going to have an impact. I don't think it's hard to argue against that. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, I agree. But there's happened a lot since then, right? The shadow fleet wasn't as large as it was. So that's taken a lot of that transport work. So at least the way we look at it on the data, it does seem to support that if you believe a meaningful part of the gray fleet is removed, then maybe despite the overall ton miles coming down, it might not be a negative after all. But maybe perhaps on the relative more towards the larger ships.
We've done a study fairly recently where we're trying to see the offset against the loss of ton mile versus the loss of the shadow fleet, and it's close to a wash. But then you have a knock-on effect of if Russian oil goes to Europe, where's the US oil going to go? West African oil, what is going to be pushed out? And then you can continue into that rabbit hole forever, which we don't have time for today, I'm sure.
Yeah, I agree. And then, Lars, because it's interesting with these illicit vessels, right, and how they trade, that they're very inefficient. So that's also an argument that we see, if you lift the sanctions to some extent in one way or another, these vessels might come back, at least if the markets are strong. If they're poor, then I think, they're clear scrapping candidates. But if the markets are strong, is there an argument to be made that now these ships can be used more efficiently? Or is that just unrealistic?
No, it's, I think one needs to look at, there's granularity there. There is actually a playbook for it. In 2016, when the sanctions were lifted on Iran, we saw the NITC fleet move very quickly, or fairly quickly, back into trading efficiently and servicing Iranian exports. So I think kind of in some sort of peace treatment, I'm pretty sure the Russian-controlled fleet will be demanded that sanctions are lifted. But of course, that system is a bit slower than kind of all the EU sanctions or the US sanctions on Russian molecules and or the price cap itself. So it's a very complicated picture. But I think the easiest way is just to draw a line at 20 years. We're actually sitting here in the market where the charters are facing bills for freight for, $10, $12, $13, $14 million for a single voyage. And they still don't try to go for a 20-plus ship. They still go for a fairly modern ship and transport oil. So I think we've proven that 20-year threshold, not that there are that many commercially traded VLCCs about 20 years, but we see that threshold is pretty firm. And the same goes for the Suezmaxes and Aframaxes too. And it's the key here is also if it's a commercially, inside a system like Sarko's described, when you control the environment of the regulations you're in, you can, of course, trade a ship until it's 25 or even 30 if you want to, if it's a well-maintained ship. But if you have a commercial oil cargo that you want to trade, and, every fixture that happens around the globe happens with options, basically because people want to retain options in order to sell the oil, to another one if the chance comes around, right? I'm also looking at the insurance of the cargo. you know, it's astronomically more expensive for a 20 plus ship than for a younger ship. So kind of the whole system is built up around catering for ships that are below 20 years. And then if you just take off all the ships that are either dark blue, green, gray, whatever they are, that are about 20 years, you know, you will actually come out of this with a pretty much a reduced, or at least as a wash, as Mikkel said. It's actually not a material fleet growth. So then it comes come back to the tonne-mile story again. And the tonne-mile story is, you know, it's the same amount of oil, it's just distributed differently. And I think that equation has so many variables, it's very impossible to, or very difficult to give a good answer to how it's going to play out.
Yeah, I think the takeaway from my end, at least, it seems like less material than people might think. And it gets perhaps an outsized part of attention when it comes to investing in tankers, which I think is a more long-term story. I was going to talk about the Red Sea, but I imagine we'll get lost in that as well. So let's jump onward a bit to asset values, right? Because the strength in the market has reflected itself in stronger, in higher asset values as well, secondhand assets. And then also we've seen a very tightness at the yards, right? With all these orders coming from other sectors. You can start with you, Niklas, on the new build side. Does it make sense, in your opinion, to run to the yards in order right now, given what we're talking about? There seems to be more interest now than before.
Yes, I think we have seen a significant increase in the last 5 years on the prices. That has to do also with a better market, but also with a very tight, as you said, supply of tonnage. I think Korea is filled up with LNGs and container ships. And they're not very eager in doing, I would say, mainstream tankers. The same is in Japan. So really, you're left with China. We are building the majority of our ships still in Korea because they're all mainly shuttle tankers, and you need very high specifications for those ships. Right now, the long-term rates should not push people to build ships. If you have to pay, shy of $130 million for a VLCC for delivery 2028 or early 2029, you need really a long-term business of $60,000 a day to start making a return. So I think the market is well-balanced. Speculation should be avoided. I mean, at least that's what we try to do in our company. Of course, you need fleet. You need fleet renewal as it comes forward. But I think caution is the best, and that's what has. If it was not for the uncertainty of the net zero effect, all of us would have ordered more ships going forward, and we would not have been enjoying the market we do.
You mentioned it, Mikkel, quite a bit of a renewal need as well. But having followed you for the past few years, you've sort of been waiting in time, biding your time when it comes to investing, because asset values have been high, new build prices have been relatively high in historical context. Have you missed out, is the major order now coming, or where are we?
I mean, a time machine would be nice, of course. There's no denying that, but. I do think it seems a little bit frothy right now in terms of just seeing the absolute levels being printed. I think also the yards are in a very comfortable place. They have a fairly long forward order book and very good levels, but also suggest they are making a decent return on the price they're building at right now. You don't see opening slots coming out and being available for long. They're happy to repeat last dams as well. So even though, yes, it's increased in the last 2 or 3 months here on the back of the tanker spike, what has really appreciated more has been secondhand and resales, naturally. So again, it does mean that there's maybe a slight cap on what the yards are or how much further they can push it. At the same time, we have seen capacity growing with the yards, and I think that capacity is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. One of the things I think was mentioned before, this is the first time, I think Mr. Sacco was mentioning it, that this is one of the few times in the history of shipping where a lot of segments has been firing on all cylinders together at the same time. And that's really what's been keeping the yards busy and been pushing the new build prices up to these levels. So, but at the same time as well, as I said before, yes, we've seen these slots coming out on a regular basis. I think we started into this year, we were told there was no slots left anywhere for the 27 delivery. I think it's only 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a 27 new build being ordered again. So there is things being slipping out. By the same time, can't be counter to that is that we do see a lot of money on the sidelines. So when these slots do come out into the market, they are being snatched up fairly close to last done fairly quickly. So it's trying to get that thing right. And that's what one of the focus areas. I mean, you're absolutely right, Jan. It's one of the focus areas we're going to have for next year, trying to see how when we get in front of that. But it could be a little bit of downward pressure still.
Yeah, and but you've had, you know, the second-hand asset values have been high, one can argue, but the equity valuations have, you know, strengthened a lot as well. So I just want to touch on that before we go. I know I'm stretching my time. I hope you all have a bit more time. I'll try to run through quickly. But you're keeping a lot of liquidity on the balance sheet, Mikkel. Why is that?
Well, I think you mentioned 4 or 5 times already, we have an older fleet and we have to renew. So we got a problem that these other three gentlemen doesn't have. And I think we know in this market, the thing you can rely on is cold cash. And we need a lot of it to renew the fleet and to grow the fleet. And it's not a, of course, we could, I don't think this time is going to be a quick fix. It's going to be a grind. This could take a while to get this right and get the age profile to the way we want to. And I think there's a starting to be an understanding in analysts and investors that this is the for the long term view and for the long term value creation of TK, this is the right path. We are focused more and more on the value, not necessarily on the valuation, and that might mean that we'll see. We're not so focused on the next quarter. We're more focused on the several years ahead of us. And we think if we do that and if we focus on that and being responsible in renewing the fleet, then the valuation over time will take care of itself. If we focus on the business, which is what the shareholders are ultimately betting on that we're doing. And that's what we've been doing this year. Yeah, this year we've been selling a little bit more than we've been buying, but we hope that it's going to reverse in the next year and the coming years and keep us busy that way. And again, it's an exciting prospect. We're really looking forward to getting stuck in with this. And again, it's not just secondhand, it's also the new builds. And so when we have to look at all options available to us as we go through this.
There has been a very clear development when you see the companies that have paid out a lot of dividends. They've been greatly appreciated in the public markets. Yeah, go ahead.
But if you look at the total shareholder returns over the last 3-5 years, TK is up there with the best of them. And I think that's more, again, if you're looking for volatility in the front end, maybe we're not quite there. But in terms of long-term shareholder returns, I think we performed extremely well. And that's kind of how we're positioning ourselves.
Yeah, I mean,
we, like others, we have almost a 40% year-to-year increase on the share price. But I still believe that, we are very, very cheap. In the sense, because we should start valuing long-term companies like all of us here with a business model more on a P ratio rather than, I mean, we are actually trading at 2x EBITDA, which is, I would say, ridiculous. We have, this year, we will, I think, exceed $500 million of EBITDA and $1 billion of net, anyway, and like all the other companies. So we will need from people like yourselves, the analysts, to start looking this industry not like just floating real estate, just valuing anything on net asset value, but also on the longer term story. All the companies that are here have been around for 20 years, so it's we're not just startups that just going through a cycle. We've been through many cycles, all of us successfully. I think all of the companies that are there through ups and downs. So we need to find a way to revalue the industry to get more respect of what we do as an industry rather than just the cold steel.
Yeah, I don't disagree. But then again, I moving over to you, Svein. I think you you've done a very, very solid strategic shift in that matter, right? Because you've had a very pronounced dividend strategy, which is also directly tied to the PE and or the you know the earnings in the company over time. Yeah, and I do think, you know, if you put put money where your mouth is, then usually the valuation tends to end up the same way. To you then, Svein, given that you're now pricing above NAV and things are looking very good on the valuation side, admittedly, during the upturn, when I do the math on the sensitivities for cash flow, you do have a bit of coverage, right? And talk to us about the thinking behind that, doing the time charter rates and a bit more visibility on earnings rather than just playing the spot cycle and how that ties into your capital allocation.
It's all trying to strike a balance. So in all fairness now, we have six time charters coming off in the next few months. So they are, of course, up for either spot market exposure at elevated rates, or they are up for potential renewals at also higher rates than what they come off. I think over time, it's sort of been serving us well to have a mixed portfolio. I think in order to sort of earn that that premium, you know, we are a company with a very open shareholder base. There's no sponsor behind the company and whatnot. So we had to earn our stripes ourselves, so to say. The combination now of a very low leveraged company, so a strong balance sheet, and that clearly defined the dividend policy, I think is now earned credibility because people think this is something that we can run with for a longer time. It's not just a policy that we can do in a strong market. So I think that that certainly serves us well. I do think that we have a long track record in how we allocate capital in general, because there are three other purposes of the capital apart from the dividend. It's either investments in vessels. Also from time to time, when we've been down in the market, we also done buybacks at very accretive levels. Or we have invested in the balance sheet. So this combination over time has been sort of consistent value creation for the company. And I think the market is quite honest, right? They are responding to this by supporting how we're being priced at the market. But I think just a comment on TSR. The key input in TSR is the date you start to calculate your TSR, right? So... So we can all choose which periods we want to look at, and we can all look super fabulous, you know, by choosing the right periods. So the thing is also to look at the number of periods of this to see how you fare over time, not just in a short snapshot, right?
And the longer the better, usually. But then I don't know if it was that was aimed at Lars, Svein, but there is a principle. There's a principle that has been in the background. Yeah. But you've also achieved very strong pricing over time consistently. And I think your take is a bit different, right? You've actually been going out saying that you're underlevered. So how do you view the same things?
No, it's we're comfortable. I'm trying to say with a higher leverage too. The question has normally been related to, whether if we're going to use money to, pay back banks or, kind of distribute dividends. And we tend to distribute dividends, and we're actually quite happy, paying back our debts according to schedule. And also we've been in a position where we've kind of been a little bit more cash rich than we probably like to be. But this goes back to Nicolas Sarko's point, is that, to invest in this market, you need a kind of a pretty firm belief in the market in order to do so. We haven't really seen the long-term time charter rates follow the asset pricing. And spot pricing has only kind of started to improve the asset pricing, in the last kind of month. So of course we're growing confidence and potentially meaning that we are in a situation where it's more likely that you take an aggressive stance. But I have to remind the audience that we did a very kind of big transaction only 2 years back, where we really drew up our debts. But I think on the pricing, it's kind of strange. And this is just on a general note, because if you look at, if I was an investor in tankers, which I am actually, but You know, right now, there's a lot of stars aligning, and the amount of cash that we're generating from trading the oil, the freight market right now is unprecedented. So it's basically like all the shareholders' wishes are coming through at the same time, before Christmas even. And still, people are reluctant to let the share prices run. You know, it's that is maybe a question for you, Jürgen. You know, what you know, are we missing the next buyer of tanker stocks? You know, are they all kind of have they all bought what they needed for Christmas and so forth? Because I'm just a bit stumbled that, you know, just talking about our own company, you know, we traded at $30, you know, a year and a half ago, and all on expectations and the air. And now we actually have the physical numbers here. Well, all of us do on this call, and the shareholders seem to be reluctant to kind of push the buy button. You know, well, what's the explanation?
We're struggling a bit with the same thing, but I do realize that there are perhaps more people calling me asking when is sort of the peak, right? Rather than and that's in a near term perspective, I think. And then there's a lot of uncertainty to all the things that we've just discussed, right? And I do think that's part of the reason why people are a bit reluctant when things have gone as good as you say, Lars. It's easier to sell people a story that things have upside rather than saying, now we have the numbers, why aren't you giving us credit for it? Because then people are already looking around the next corner for the next bad guy. And I'm a bit afraid that that's been part of it. But I don't disagree. And I do feel that, you know, the compounding of value that happens very quickly in these types of markets. And I think what investors really need to notice is that, you know, when markets first are tight, as they are right now, the upside optionality to the potential earnings in tankers and shipping overall is incredibly interesting. And that's back to the point, I think, and back to you, Niklas. I think evaluating companies on NAV makes complete sense. If you believe that the value of the steel is correct, and it should be, because it should be reflective of what you earn. So when we value companies, at least we look 1 year ahead, 2 years ahead when it comes to cash generation included. And then, you know, that encompasses part of that outlook, in our opinion, at least, on our assessed values. But I do find it interesting that it seems people are actually pretty bullish in tankers. It seems like they're willing to pay up at strong valuations. Given the belief that you know, this might continue, it's not to say that things are fully priced, but you know, valuation does look good in a historical context, and there might be more to run. I've kept you way too long, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I probably could sit here and speak much longer, but I'll try to let you go back to do high fixings closer to $200,000 a day for the VLCCs. I hope that that's the best. So with that, I'd just like to thank all the panelists and those calling, dialing in and listening to this webinar, and wish you all a Merry Christmas when the time comes.
Say Merry Christmas to everybody.
Thank you.
And we're paying a dividend on the 19th, so people can go shopping.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.